So with the previous group of philosophy guys, I did an introduction to moral philosophy. I'll do a very brief, and then I want to do one interesting source with you that really cuts to it. What? Previous core, yeah. Meaning, because previous core, right, Ginsburg was in America, so I had like 3 weeks with them. But let's see what you know about ethics. I know Ray Aronson's been doing some moral philosophy with you, right? No? Okay, fine. So let's do a brief overview here. So what are if you go to intro to ethics, let's say in University of Chicago next year, Rabbi Rosen, so they're going to tell you they're probably going to introduce you most likely to three ethical theories, three types of ethical theories. Okay, and they will be the following, right? One is going to be consequentialist ethics. Okay, what is consequentialist ethics?
Ethics based on the
right. Consequentialist ethics is any theory of ethics that assumes that what makes something ethical or not is the results of your actions, the results of what happens, right? Not intention, not anything, results.
Is that
Yes, meaning in theory, yes. Now, what is the most famous modern version of consequentialism? Utilitarianism, right? Is the idea that the purpose of morality is to bring the greatest amount of happiness to the most number of people. Now, obviously, there's a lot of complexity in even within utilitarianism. You know, what exactly do you mean by happiness? Is it purely quantifiable? Are there different types of happiness? Can you distinguish between pure hedonic happiness and like purpose and things like that? And obviously this becomes, you know, there's differences between who are the main thinkers that if you're just like throwing out famous names that are
John Stuart Mill,
Jeremy Bentham. And then if you go to 20th century, you're going to talk about 2021st, like currently you'd think like Peter Singer is probably one of the leading utilitarians. But then you get into all type of complicated theories like, okay, well, who counts? Is it only human beings? Is it, you know, is it, right? What about animals? Is it only things with sentience? How do you determine sentience? And then you get, you know, in the even more modern versions, if you start going to the, I'm in the middle of Reality Plus by David Chalmers, where, you know, he thinks that we are living in a simulation, and he thinks that virtual worlds are real. So he starts dealing with what would you do? How do you start determining, consequentialism once you start dealing with virtual worlds? These things get very complicated. But one branch of ethical theory is what's known as consequentialism, where what determines whether something is ethical is the results. Okay. At the opposite extreme, you have deontological theory of ethics. What's a deontological theory of ethics? To rule-based theory of ethics. And that basically means that what is ethical is follow the rules. Right? Now, there are different types of deontological theories. There's divine ethics theories, right? Obviously religious ones, but there's also secular versions. The most famous secular, well, he wasn't himself secular, but his theory is secular. Right? The most famous modern deontologist is Immanuel Kant. Right? Where Kant, right, has several formulations that go into it, but basically for him, what makes something ethical is there's a rule. For him, the rule is the categorical imperative, which is, right, well, there are different versions even within the categorical imperative, right, but always treat others as ends and not as means. And the method by way he figures it out is he says, okay, imagine a certain action, imagine that you then expand it and say, if everyone acted this way, would I think that was moral? If the answer is yes, then it's moral, and then you can never break it. And he's an extremist, right? Famously, Kant says that since lying is immoral, it's immoral under all circumstances, and if a murderer would come and ask you where your son is, you would not be allowed to lie to save your son's life because you'd be violating the rules, and that would be immoral, which is an extreme. Now, there are a lot of problems to consequentialism and extreme deontology. So, for example, one of the major critiques of consequentialism is what's known as, doing a little chazara because they weren't here, is the moral luck argument, right? What's the moral luck? Moral luck. Luck. Right? Well, right? The moral luck argument is that really fair? I try to be the best person in the world, right? I see someone you know, starving to death, right? So I run, you know, I put them on my shoulders. I carry them, you know, 5 miles, right? Until I find food, right? The first time I see food is, you know, there's a supermarket that sees the situation and realizes they can gouge me because I'm clearly such a good person and I'll pay anything. And I pay them $10,000 for, you know, a morsel of food to save this guy. And, you know, the only food that they have is a Reese's Pieces. And I pay $10,000 for the Reese's Pieces. I put it in his mouth. Turns out he's allergic to peanut butter and he dies, right? So inconsequentialism, you are a murderer, right? 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 On the other hand, right, if someone says, oh, I really hate that guy, and he takes out his gun and shoots him, and it turns out that it goes, right, he meant to kill him, but he doesn't have a great aim, and instead it goes, right, you know, he was aiming for his heart, but it goes, right, like, a little bit off his heart, and instead there happens to be a tumor, unbeknownst to anybody, and it knocks out the tumor, right, before it metastasizes, and he saves his life, oh, Sadiq Gamur, right? That this is the problem with consequentialism is the moral luck argument. The third major theory of ethics is known as virtue ethics. Right? Virtue ethics means that among the central purposes of ethics is not just what you do, but the type of person that you become. Right? Now, it shares certain qualities with the others, but that's what makes virtue unique, right? Virtue ethics is unique in the sense that we care about the type of person you become. And therefore, if, let's say, you simply have a tremendous force of will, you are really a stingy person, like deep inside. But you have force of will, so every time someone asks you for charity, you go out of the way and you give them charity. From a deontological point of view, you're a great person. From a consequentialist perspective, you're a good person. From a virtue ethics perspective, you're not. Because you are not a giving person, right? If you have to struggle, you are not yet a perfected human being, right? So classically, this is, in classical philosophy, Aristotle is the most important virtue ethicist. And in Jewish philosophy, the Rambam is the most important virtue ethicist. Now, what we did in sort of the last core when we had more time was we pointed out that, first of all, none of these are pure. Right? In Torah, it's very hard to speak about a pure system. Right? The Rambam clearly incorporates virtue into it, but it's much more complicated than that. But that's like a 10-minute summary of like the three main, right, ethical theories. And obviously, there are nuances. As we, you know, we did, and Michael can tell you as we did last time, first of all, in halacha, like I said, there is no single theory, right? It's clear that there are multiple theories at play. It does matter which one you take. So, for example, the Rambam has practical nafkaminas to the fact that he's a virtue ethicist. So the Rambam asked the question, what happens if I have the option of giving $1 million to one person or $1,000 to 1,000 people? Which one should I do? So the Rambam says you should give $1,000 to 1,000 people because it's more likely to, right, by repeating an action over and over, it's more likely to affect your person, right, your personality. And therefore, it is preferable to do the 1,000 actions, which is going to shape your personality, rather than to give $1 million. Now, the Rambam also thinks that this isn't just pragmatic advice. He also thinks this is a mitzvah d'oraita. He thinks v'halachta b'drachav tells you that developing positive virtue is an independent mitzvah asay beyond the actions that you're doing, right? So if I'm kind to Rabbi, that might be a kiyum of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. But becoming a kind person is a kiyum of v'ahavta v'drachav, and therefore the mitzvot of bikur cholim and things like that, the Rambam puts in Perek Yudalet of Hilchot Avel, and he says those are rabbinic expressions of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, but the chiyuv to be rachum, right, to be a merciful person, he puts in a chodeyot. Right, so the Rambam very clearly sees these as two things that are happening. The same action can contribute to two separate mitzvot, to two separate goals. What I want to do here is is show you, as you know, as I mentioned, that one of the things that's very clear is that halacha doesn't have a purist system. So, for example, while the Rambam thinks that tzedakah, you should focus on virtue, many poskim assume that by tzedakah, we actually care about consequences. That's not true of all mitzvot, but by tzedakah, we do. So that's why many poskim assume that the Gemara says you're allowed to give tzedakah and test God and say, I'm giving tzedakah in order to become rich. Now, the Gemara says it only by Meiser. Some poskim assume it's by all tzedakah. For simplicity, let's say you could do it by all tzedakah. Uvechanuni navazot. And so several of the Mepharshim say, why are you allowed to do that? How could you test God? So they say it's only by tzedakah, because by tzedakah, God wants the poor people to be helped. And therefore, by tzedakah, we care more about consequences. So is it pure? No. And God wouldn't want you to test him for Shabbos. He wouldn't want to say, make me rich and I'll say Kiddush. But by tzedakah, where it's consequentialist in nature, or there's a heavy consequentialist component to tzedakah, so we can do that. Okay? No, you will. The Gemara actually says, test him. Aser bishvil shittit asher. Now, don't ask me how this works in practice, but anyway. So, again, that's not the only way to explain it. Many of the Mepharshim assume the reason you can do that is because God normally cares about intentions, and saying, I'm going to do the mitzvah so I can become rich is bad intentions. But by tzedakah, God doesn't care, because what matters is... No, in Echanami, that's not the emphasis. The emphasis is the fact that you're doing it for the wrong reasons, but who cares? Right? Is that, I don't care why you do it as long as it gets done. Right? And that's why God lets you test him on this. Again, we can give a whole shiur on any aspect of this. But what I want to do is show you... So what's always tricky with this is that if you want to see how this plays out in halacha, so you could look at the Rambam who writes, you know, treatises about halacha. Right, she's about philosophy, rather. But a lot of times, right, you need to tease it out. So what I want to show is go through one piece in Yosef Engel, where you're going to see that he actually very subtly understands these different systems, but he also thinks that, as I said, halacha has a hybrid system, but he has a very particular claim about which types of mitzvot reflect which type of ethical theory. Okay, and that's what I want to do, is just show you how to read, you know, what's basically a Lumdish text, but with a sort of a philosophical eye. Okay, so this is Asman Doraita Yud Gimel. So he was asked as follows. He says, "Bishos bavakama davtzadi dalad amud bet maaseh ba'adam echad." There was once a person who was a thief, Gazlan, shebikesh laso tshuva. He wanted to repent. Amar lo ishto, his wife said to him, Reka, you idiot. Im ata oseh tshuva, if you repent, afilu avnet eno shalcha. Even your own belt you will no longer own. Meaning you are such a thief, right? Everything we own is from theft. You can't do this. Vinimna velo asa tshuva. So we didn't do tshuva. When the rabbis heard about this, ba'otasha amru agazlaninu malavi ribichin iru ein mekaplim neyem. The rabbi said that any thief or someone who borrows with interest, if he tries to return the money, we don't accept it. And the one who accepts it, the rabbis aren't happy with you. Tashma, haroim vagabayin vamochsin shuvatad kashet. Wait a second. The shepherds and the gabay, the tax collectors and the like, we say their tshuva is very difficult. Why? Because they stole from the public. And they don't know who they stole from. So he says, why is tshuva hard? You don't have to return it. So the Gemara says, no, they should return it, even though we don't accept it. So Ella Lama Mahzirin. So why do they return it at all? Let's say Shamai. And then the Gemara says, well, if they don't actually have to give it back, Iyach Yamai Tshuva Tzadkashem. For the sake of God, right? The Gemara says, I mean, okay, like they have to at least try. Yeah, right, depends how you take that line.
Zahara Shepherds
What do they do?
Oh, they let their animals graze on other people's property. Now, I'm not going to get into the full sugya here, right? Tosfot there says maybe it was only for his generation that they did this, and some of them, Farshim, say there's a difference between someone who wants to do tshuva and someone who baits and catches him. If he catches him, you can take the money back. It's if someone legitimately does tshuva, maybe not. It might depend whether someone robs a lot or only robs once, right? If he robs once, you take it back, but if it was his whole profession, and therefore he just can't, right, extricate himself without destroying himself, so then we don't make him give back. All types of different explanations. So he says, V'lachora mai parech, harei al-poponim linin yatzei shemayim tshuva shen kasher. He says, well, I understand the Gemara's problem. If he's not obligated to give the stuff back, but to make God happy, he is. So that still means their tshuva is hard, because ideally he should give it back. So I want to explain, because in order to explain this, I want to set out the following theory. Okay? Now again, this is a very lumjah sugya, but you're going to see that what he's going to do is acknowledge different types of ethical systems within halacha itself. Actually, you know, before I see, forget for a moment this halachic analysis. If I asked you, okay, you have three basic ethical theories, and I'm going to tell you in advance that halacha does not map on perfectly to what you get in Intro to Ethics 101, okay? But it's still relevant. Which areas of halacha would you say, right? If you would want to make a distinction between different types of mitzvah, different type of halacha, which ones of them would you think might reflect one ethical theory versus another? Why? Okay, I need to defend it. Don't throw like terms out. Like, is there a distinction? Right. Let's again, assuming that halacha doesn't perfectly map onto Kantian deontological ethics or Millian or Benthamite, you know. Mm-hmm. Utilitarianism, which is not the same. Shet Teda, they don't have the same. Also, Mill is not consistent, because Mill, in certain places, is a deontologist, so ignore that. But okay, for sake of argument. Yeah, well, we didn't do this piece. Okay, fine, but you can throw out things, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I remember correctly. I think Ben Adam Lamakom and Ben Adam
Lamakom. So one possibility would be Ben Adam Lachavir or Ben Adam Lamakom. In what way?
In the battle between, like, virtue ethics and deontological ethics.
Meaning, right. So one way of thinking is, look, by Ben Adam La Makom, we care about
what God says to do.
Right. So you could say Ben Adam La Makom is just God said X, do X. It's a rule-based thing. Where it comes to Ben Adam La Chavero, you could say it's more, well, we already know that virtue is part of it, right, Rachum? But you could also say
consequentialism.
We saw it by Tzedakah, right? Ah, very good. But Elijah says, well, why do you say that? Maybe Ben Adam Lamakom, it's a different virtue. It's not kindness, but maybe it's obedience. Maybe it's commitment, right? There are spiritual virtues, right? Not just, you know, what we would call in sort of the West, ethical virtues.
You also said that Ben Adam Lamakom is also just divine.
Right, and you could, if you wanted to, you could say Ben Adam Lamakom. Right, you could, right? So, but one possible distinction beyond Ben Adam Lamakom, but again, it's not so neat. Right, and not nor is it necessary. Right, what else?
The chukim could be, I mean, all
right. So you could distinguish chukim and mishpatim, right? That chukim, right? So this is actually something the Rambam does say explicitly, right? That chukim. This is the Rambam's position that chukim, things that don't make sense, it's just deontological, right? Because I don't know why I'm keeping it. So the only value is keeping it. Right, and the Rambam uses this to distinguish the following: that philosophers say it's better, as I said, to not have to fight your desire to sin. Right, you should naturally want to do the right thing. On the other hand, many sources in Chazal say, "Don't say I don't want to eat not kosher. Say I want to, but what can I do? God said don't eat it." So the Rambam says, does this contradict Aristotle? Rachmana Litzlan, why should Chazal do that? He says, no, it doesn't contradict Aristotle. He says, it depends. By a chok, by shatnez, or basar b'chalav, or pork, or whatever. There's nothing non-ethical about it. God said it, so you do it. But he says, notice the Midrash says, don't say, I don't want to eat shatnez, you know, whatever. I don't want to wear shatnez. I don't want to eat basar b'chalav. He doesn't say, don't say, I don't want to murder. that I want to murder, but what can I do? God said no. Right? Because like, that's crazy. No one wants, right? No one wants their best friend, someone who says, listen, I want you to know, Rabbi, I have a tremendous amount of self-control. So I would never hurt you. I will be very nice to you. But you know, deep down, all I really want to do is strangle you to death. That's all I really want to do. No one wants that person as a friend. I mean, it's completely crazy. Right? No one wants that. She says it's different in Chok and Mishpat. That Chok, the value in keeping it is because God said so. By Mishpat, what? What do you mean why? Because you don't know why you're keeping it. By Chok, you don't know why. It doesn't matter whether there's no, that's a machlok rishonim, whether chok is something that has no reason or we don't know the reason. But either way, you can't say that I imbibe the values of the chok because I don't know what the value is supposed to be. Even if you say there is a reason, but I don't know what it is. So how am I supposed to say I'm becoming, what is the value I'm trying to,
I understand.
Right? Meaning what am I supposed to say? I don't know why I'm not wearing shatnez, but I want to be a not shatnez wearing perfect. Like, what is that? I like it. Brother, what is that? Right? There's no. I don't know what the value is supposed to be.
There's no reason behind it. Why
would you do it? If there's no reason behind it, but even if there is a reason, I don't know what it is. Right.
Right. If you should want.
Right. So the Rambam distinguishes between chok and mishpat, not ben al chaver ben al mako. But what the Avin d'Oraita is going to do is show that sometimes, even within very similar mitzvot, it could be that the difference between them is precisely not is the orientation in terms of what how you articulate the value. Even though the mitzvah sound the same, they split on these lines. So this is what he does. Now again, he's coming at this not as a philosopher. He's coming at this in, as a lamdan. And he says, okay, here's the sugya. Gidin mem aleph I amud aleph. Sugya de chatzi evel chatzi ben chorin. In case you didn't know what chet ayin chet bet aleph means. Right, is chatzi eved chatzi ben chorin, a half slave, half free man. Right, that's a person who was once owned by two masters, and only one of them freed him. Okay, so the Gemara says that shekatzul kach nagan medin dahatam asay d'shevet. So the Gemara says that you free him. Why do you free him? So that he can get married. Okay, because. Because of the half of him that's an Eved, he can't marry a Jew. Because of the half of him that's free, he can't marry a Shivcha, right? And therefore, you have to free him. And the Gemara there quotes the Pasuk of La Shevet Yitzara. The reason is, because the Pasuk says in Yeshayahu, Lo Tohu Bira'a La Shevet Yitzara, that the world wasn't created to be empty, it was created to be settled. But Tosfot already asks, but wait a second, what does the Gemara not quote? Purvu. Right, if what you're saying is you have to free him so you can get married and have kids, so you should have quoted Purvu. But it doesn't. Velasa de Purvu. So Mishum de Ase de Shevet Adifa. Ava Mishum Ase de Purvu lo ayinu kofin l'rabo l'shachro. Because in this sense, Shevet is preferable over Purvu. And for Purvu, we wouldn't have forced his master to free him. Kevan da eved patur mimena da anasu. So Tosfot says, because for Puravu we wouldn't free him because he is, what's anus? Right, he's in a state of coercion, meaning he has no way of doing it. And the halacha is anus rachmana patre. That if you're in a state of coercion, it's not your fault, you're patur. What's the obvious problem?
I mean, first one also.
Yeah, it's great, right? So that's true of Shevet. Whatever Shevet is, the chiyuv derabanan of Puruvu, according to Tosfot, to have more children. He says, "V'inei gamzetzar chavanat the chiyuv da onis potro imkein mali ase adifa o ase stama hari b'shneim anusu." He can't be mekayim either. He's in. It's not his fault. Upater mishneim in adin. Right, he said, I don't understand what you're talking about. You're telling me that you don't free him to keep Puravu because, well, he can't get married. Not his fault. He can't get married. He can't put Makayim Shevet either. What do you want from my life? He says, aha. V'nir l'fiyah ni'adati. D'hinei had da'onez rachmana patre. So he says, the notion that an unavoidable coercive state exempts you from liability. Yalfinan. We learn from the fact that the Torah doesn't hold a rape victim guilty of being raped. He says, But ones can only get you out of punishment. Aval sheyoila ones liftor mikium asay, ze lo matzinu. But an ones can't exempt you from fulfilling an asay. Dinehi dilochaora ein nafkamina ichayev olo. The sof sof ha anusu. The ein yachol lakayim. Im kolza achareha iyun nimtzu kama nafkutot bezeh.
He says, okay, by a lota asay, you're exempt. By an asay, you are not held liable. Now he says, what's the difference? He says, now you'll tell me there's no difference, because if I'm not held liable for not doing the asay, so then what's the difference between saying I'm not held liable or I'm actually exempt? He said, but what's the nafkamina? Who cares? So he says, I'm just debating whether to do this. Well, very good, right? He says, listen, he says, here's the difference. By a prohibition, if you aren't held liable, so then what's left? Nothing. What about by an assay?
I mean, if you're exempt from it, or
yeah, if I'm exempt from it, so now what? Right, meaning, but I still didn't do it.
Right.
Right, meaning, the mitzvah is supposed to happen, and what? I mean, I may not be held liable, but I didn't do it. So he says, "V'nei matzino as a machloket ben adrisha v'atatz b'nen as v'layochol leipalot tefila achad imchayev lashlim b'zman tefila shniya olav." So there's a machloket taz. And the drisha. If someone was, right, he missed davening, but ones, does he have to even make it up in the next tefillah? So the Taz says, the pligibed bazet im ones pochul lagamre velo shayach hashlama kevin shloim mechuyev klal bishato dil mechuyev ayah shloim yachol lekayim lagamre. He says there is a nafkamina between saying you're not held liable and you're exempt, and that is you have to make it up. But I want to come up with a compromise. He says there is a difference, but again, he's going to make the distinction, unlike what we saw in the Rambam himself, between benam lachavero ben adam lamako. And he says, b'mitzvot shebin adam la'makom levad u'bazas var notenet in HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'avetrunya im briyotav. He says, listen, when it comes to mitzvot bin adam la'makom, God is not trying to trip you up. U'mechayev ach et mi sheyachol l'kayem ha'mitzvah. He only obligates one who can do the mitzvah, v'anus eino mechuyev klal. And if I can't do it, so I'm not obligated. Because God only demands what is possible. But bet, the second category is mitzvot shebin adam lachavero. But mitzvot shebin adam lachavero kimo asiyad ma'ake. Like building a parapet on your roof, right? A protective fence so people don't fall off. Upriyat balchov, or the obligation to pay back a loan. V'chadoma duhum mitzad to'elet chavero. That those mitzvot, right? Why do I build a ma'akeh? No, right, what does he say? Mitzad to'elet chavero. Yeah, what we call, right? What we call consequences or utilitarianism, right? U'bivadai lo ne'emar b'kmo zed imu onos v'nyochol azot ma'akeh shemit ba'atzmuto. You can't say by a ma'akeh that I'm sorry, I was onus, and therefore it's as if it was built. It may not be my fault, but someone may still fall off my roof. Therefore, the best you can say is you're exempt. But you can't say it's if you did it. And I have to pay back a loan. Not by mitzvah lamakom to call ikor achiv uach mitzad ritzono yitparach bilvad. By bin adam lamakom, the mitzvah is only
because God wanted you to do it. Shenasa adavar ahu v'anach b'chuyavim la'asot ritzono. We have to do what God said. So if it's anus, I'm not obligated at all. There's no inyan of this mitzvah. God only commanded he who can keep. So what does he do? Right? Think about what he's doing. It's a lumdish point. But what is he? But it's really a philosophical point. Right? What is he saying? I didn't say mitzvah. I say mitzvah lota. Say he says, right. He takes the b'adam l'chaver ben l'makom argument. He says, listen, by ben adam l'makom, it's really the way he takes it. Again, you can argue, but I want to show you how philosophical language can help you understand at a deeper level what's going on right in halacha. He says ben adam l'makom is fundamentally deontological, right? And as I said, divine command is a form of deontology. You follow the rules. God wants you to listen. So he says, if that's the case, then what if I do everything that I can to listen, but I can't help it? I'm stuck. Then not only did you not lose out, God can choose to say, it's as if you did the mitzvah. Why? Because what is the value from a deontological perspective of doing an ethical act? Yeah, the act itself, doing the right thing. And did you do the right thing? Well, you did the right thing as much as you possibly can do the right thing. And therefore, so you didn't actually fulfill it. But God can say, okay, but the point of mitzvot is to do the right thing. And you were doing everything you could. So you didn't actually fulfill it. But I'll make it as if you did because you followed the rules. Maybe you didn't actualize this rule, but you did everything you could. Right? And remember we said one of the big differences between consequentialist ethics and deontological ethics is do you have moral luck? So he's saying, listen, by deontological, there's no moral luck. It's not my fault that someone prevented me from keeping the mitzvah. I did everything I was supposed to, right? I took my donation and I put it in the box, right? Little did I know that, right, the tzedakah box had a hole in the bottom and someone was stealing. I didn't know, right? He stole me, right? He stole it from me. I didn't know, but so from a consequentialist perspective, I didn't do the right thing. But he says, by deontology, there is no moral luck. So the fact that I was prevented to do the mitzvah, that's not my fault. Your job is to do the right thing. You tried to do the right thing. That's like doing the right thing. You followed the rules. Right now, it's a twist on deontology, admittedly, because he's saying, I didn't even do the act, but I tried to do it. And that's enough. You tried to keep the rules. That's enough. He says, b'dvadam l'makom, right? That's not true. B'dvadam l'makom, why do I have to have a makeh? Ben al chaver, rather, right? Why do I need a ma'akeh? To make sure someone doesn't fall off. If someone held me at gunpoint so I couldn't get up there and build my parapet, and in the meantime, someone goes up and falls off the roof, so the most you can say is, it's not my fault. But you can't say you did the right thing. You didn't. The person died, right? He says, ben al chaver, he thinks, are fundamentally consequentialist in nature, and therefore the best honest can do is say it's not your fault. But it can't say you did an ethical act. You didn't. You just aren't held responsible for not doing an ethical act. Right? It's a very subtle point. Now, really the difference he's saying is between mitzvot that are result-oriented and action-oriented. He just happens to think that mitzvot ben l'chavero map onto result-oriented mitzvot, and therefore are consequentialist in nature, and mitzvot ben l'makom are act-oriented and therefore more deontological in nature. You didn't have to say that, right? You could find counterexamples of, you know, ben adam l'makoms that are also consequentialist. But this is his theory. So he says that those are consequentialist, right? And therefore, at best, you can be held not responsible.
You can't be held not responsible.
You, what do you mean? You're not held responsible, but you didn't do it. Lamai nafkamina. Now, this sounds like a distinction with no difference, right? Like, who cares? What does it mean? Okay, at the end of the day, I'm going to go to Shemayim. God's going to say, okay, these you couldn't do, but I'll make it if you did this. You aren't guilty. Okay, but come on. What is, right? You got to put some meat on this. Where'd Robbie go? Robbie! But what I find fascinating about this is not just that, okay, he seems to be very sensitive to ethical issues, obviously without ever taking an intro to ethics course or whatever. But, maybe he did. Is
what he does in the next move shows you how he thinks. And again, my point is, you know, if you ask me why it's important to study ethics, it's not because halacha maps onto them. It's because it helps you, right? It broadens your understanding. It helps you understand the types of, right, very, right, what's going on, right, in formal halacha. Right? You can get a lot from having this language. But what the next move he makes is so, I don't know what you want to say. It sounds like it's splitting hairs, but it shows you just the perspective you can get. He says, listen, let's return. Remember how he got into this? He says, let's go back to it. Purvu is the mitzvah d'oraita that tells you you should have kids, which according to halacha means that you're not pater until you have a boy and a girl. Shevet, according to Tosfot, is the mitzvah d'rabbanan, that you should have more children than that. You should populate the world. Right? It's either a formal mitzvah d'rabbanan, or as some would have it, it's more of a gilui ratzon HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that it shows you God wants a populated world. Now, both of them say you should have children. But he says, yeah, but there's a difference. Purvu, listen to the words. Pru-urvu umilu et aretz. What does that mean? You shall have children. What is the pasuk in Yeshayahu? Lo tohu bira'ah. The world isn't created for right? Lashevet yitzarah. It's general. So he says, wait a second. That means even with having children, there's two aspects to it. One is deontological. The other is consequentialist. He said there's another nafkamina to this, and that is the following. A deontological mitzvah, a deontological act, can you outsource it to somebody else?
No.
What about a consequentialist one? Or put it... Ah, very good. So now he says, but it's not just that. Push it farther. For a deontological act, am I responsible for you to do the right thing? Not quite. But what about consequentialism? We are at some level. Because the whole point of consequentialism is, right? Yes, Areva takes on a different meaning when you're talking about consequences. By a deontological thing, you might say, listen, you're chayav in a mitzvah, I'm chayav to make sure you do the mitzvah, but I'm not actually chayav in your mitzvah. I'm chayav to get you to do the mitzvah. But by something which is fundamentally consequentialist, we're actually chayav in your mitzvah equally. Because we're chayav to bring about a result. Right, I'm chayav in your mitzvah, right? So he says, "Lefiza nechziana, hine b'mitzvah pirivirivya." By having children, shnei ma'ilat debatz muta, he mitzvah mechayevet min Hashem yidvarach ma'amaro pruruvu kechol mitzvot. Point one is you're obligated to have kids like any other mitzvah. Shenemar v'loshon chova, asukach v'kach, do this. Umitzad zeh he ach mitzvah mechayevet beinenu uvena makom levad. In that sense, it's between you and God. But when it says the world should be populated, it's telling you the world should be populated. That shows you that everyone has an obligation. That you have an obligation to make sure the world is populated. Ah, very good. He says like this. He says, if... Because Purvu has two aspects, a deontological aspect and a consequentialist aspect. He said, deontological aspects, he just said that anus makes you totally exempt. But by consequentialist ones, it only makes it that you're not held liable. So he says, if Purvu only had a deontological component, then would the master have to free his slave so his slave could be Mekayim Mitzvah? No, you're anus. But if it's consequentialist, that means... At best, onus makes it that you're not liable. But is the result being met? No. And now I have the ability to free the slave and to allow him to do it. So why am I chayev? Because it's a consequentialist mitzvah. Because the best you can say is you're not held responsible. But I have the ability to enable that result to come about. So I'm not responsible to make sure that someone else can fulfill his deontological responsibilities, right? But if I can enable a certain consequence, then I'm obligated, because at best, onus can only exempt you. It can only say you're not held liable, but it can't make it as if you did the mitzvah. So he says, which is a mitzvah. So onus, he's totally poter.
Aval asik the shevet, but the second aspect of it, namely that the world has to be populated, do avur tikun ha'alam, which is to perfect the world, i.e. consequentialness, v'lo shayich lomar bazeh, the came into onus ein ha'davar ba'atz muto. So you can't say, well, he's onus, so it doesn't matter. The best you can say, you're not held responsible, but the result, the consequences aren't being met. Nitzrach devadai, nitzrach l'tikun ha'alam, yishevo, im ken kol adam chayev bazeh. So the best you can say, I'm obligated, but I'm not held liable. And now we can go back to Tosfot. By Purvu, it's deontological. So if you're honest, so then you're totally putter. Again, Shaver and Kovin Adon Lashachro Avura. So you can't force the master to slave to free the slave for that. He's not obligated. I don't have to make it that you are chayiv in a mitzvah. But the aspect of having children, which is shevet, is about populating the world. Where we said, at best, you can say you're not held liable, but the obligation is still there because the consequences need to be met. It's not. And now he says, come back, Leviza, Yuvanu Atosvot, Shas Baba Kaman Al Demet, Kevin Daniel De Lamiach, Shurim Kane, Havale Onus Atab Mitzvah Shava. Elam Day Mukhuyu, and I didn't meet some Havir Shigazo, and Ain Oses Epocha, but I Mukhuyu Vala Shava. Elam Day Mukhuyu, Valkar Shapir, I think Juvan Kasha, Kim Jochla Kaim Chiuvo. Al Kavan Damar, the Chiuvo, Achlat Sitli Shamayim, Ken Achiv Achbinom, and Amakal Mavad, and Ken Kavan Shu, Onus Atta, and Yachla Shiv Shum the Gamre Potor. Etc. He says, what did Tosfot say by the stealing case? He said, listen, if you don't know who you stole from, so then, right, what's the only obligation? Let's say Yidei Shamayim, but you don't know who you stole it from. So he says, by stealing, there's two aspects. If you could return it to someone, then even if it was really hard, at best you would be unable to do it. But once you say you don't have to return it, you only have to return it, we didn't let's say Yidei Shamayim, then if it becomes too difficult, then you're patur legamre, because you're talking about the aspect between you and God, of checking off the box, of Asha v'Agzela. Right? So here's one more paragraph on this, which, you know, you can look at it. But what I wanted to highlight is simply this, right? Is that... The stealing one?
Yeah.
So he says like this. He says, by stealing, he says, okay, you don't know who to return it to. So that's a form of anus, right? But that would still be a chiyuv, right? It's an anus, but it's a chiyuv. But once we say that Chazal say you don't have to return it, you only have to return it, let's say, yidei shamayim, then what are we saying? Chazal removed the ben adam lamakom, the consequential of the heshev exela. What did they leave? Yeah, because remember, the person isn't supposed to let you give it back to him, which means the consequentialist component is gone. What's left is the deontological one. There's a formal mitzvah, heshev et exela. And then if you don't know to pay, so when it's anus, you don't have to do it. He says that's only true on the deontological component of a heshev et exela at Asher Gazal, because Chazal removed the consequentialist component and said you don't have to return it. What? That's part of that sugya, because it's too hard and it wouldn't let you do tshuva. And, okay, that's a big sugya in and of itself. But what I want to highlight here is simply what you see here. Again, this is completely a lumder speech, right? This is like a classic 19th century, right? 19th to 20th century, like lumdun, right? It's lumdus. What is the nature of ones, right? But if you have just a little basic, right, 10-minute introduction to theories of ethics, you realize that what sounds like a, right, nuanced little chakira is actually a reflection of how halacha incorporates in very nuanced ways different ethical theories. And within the same mitzvah, right, he argues that, listen, if you realize that within the mitzvah of having children, there's really two things going on. You have an obligation towards God to check off the box, puravu, and you have an obligation to society to populate the world. Then within the same mitzvah, there's a deontological component, and there's a consequentialist component. Now, you'll tell me there's no difference. He said, there is a difference. There's a, right? This isn't just theoretical. This is just ethics in the air, right? He says, no. There's a practical difference. When you can only identify a deontological component, so if you can't do it, then you're totally exempt, and no one else is responsible to ensure that you come up with the tools to fulfill the mitzvah. That's not my responsibility, because it's only about deontology. It's about keeping the rules. Right now, you're keeping the rules. I don't have to make it that you can keep the rules better. Right now, you're keeping the rules. It's not my problem. But the second you start talking about consequences, then onus at best can say you're not held liable. But there's still a lack. Because, again, the framework is, did I achieve a certain result? The answer is no. And then other people have to start weighing in because you're talking about consequences, right? And if I can do something to enable you to bring about better consequences, then I become responsible to do that, right? Because from a consequentialist perspective, I have to take your cheshbonot, right? Your ethical cheshbonot in. Right, he thinks that fundamentally this distinction of Adam Chaver and Adam Lamakom, the Bein Adam Lamakom, he says, my responsibility to God is to follow the rules, and therefore God will say, you can't do it? Fine, I'll count it as if you did. Bein Adam Chavero or consequentialist. Now, this is not obvious, right? As we saw, it's not obvious that there's a neat distinction between Adam Chaver and Adam Lamakom on this, right? And you can quibble on his application. But I just bring this example to show how a little bit of sophistication of how you talk about ethical theories can actually help you understand, right? A, again, it also proves my thesis, which is pretty obvious, which is that Torah does not and should not easily map onto the ethical theories. But mitzad sheni, there still is value to having philosophical sophistication in terms of how you talk about ethics and why it's important to do what you do, because it actually gives you a language to understand within the Torah system why certain mitzvot look a certain way, right? And it's not arbitrary. It's not just this mitzvah is like this mitzvah is like that, right? There's actually a theory that certain types of mitzvot, their value stems from a certain type of a theory, and other from a different type of theory, and then their halacha, which is what halacha does best, can give you practical language to these different theories and manifest it. Lemaisa. So this I find to be a very interesting piece. Now again, if I had 5 weeks or whatever it is like I did last time, right, we could prove, right, the existence of each of these theories, right, and more expansively. But this was one piece I hadn't covered with the whatever second round guys. But this is one way, at least a taste of theories of ethics and how you can use it to analyze halacha, even though obviously the discourses are different. But still, they add sophistication to the discussion.